23 Marines have been killed in those incidents. Now some Marine commanders refuse to let their troops fly in the Osprey because they believe it's unsafe at any angle. But do we hear outrage from any elected official in Washington about that? The only sound is ka-ching. There goes another billion of taxpayer money. And then there are the government programs that simply don't work. The Great Society programs created by Lyndon Johnson were supposed to stamp out poverty in America. The key word here is supposed to. The poverty rate in 2001 is pretty much the same as it was 35 years ago. The massive entitlement spending did benefit some Americans along the way, but welfare was a disaster. One result, the creation of a semi-permanent underclass that views government subsidies as their right. Because government bureaucrats refused to supervise welfare payments adequately, hundreds of billions of tax dollars went down the drain. To this day, the busiest time of the month for liquor stores and street dope dealers is the day the welfare checks arrive. Did President Johnson and his Great Society architects not know that sending checks to people without supervision might lead to the abuse of the money? Did they not understand that? Or did they not care, preferring to bask in the adulation that compassionate rhetoric inevitably brings? And then there's the sinkhole called the Department of Education. Title I programs were set up with the noble goal of improving education for America's disadvantaged children. 25 years and $125 billion later, 60% of poor kids in the fourth grade can barely read. For black kids, the figure is 63%. Bush's Secretary of Education, Dr. Roderick Page, is quoted as saying that Title I spending has been a total failure. So the question is, who's keeping score? Who is watching our tax dollars, and who is making sure that federally funded programs actually work? Ready? Nobody is. With trillions in annual spending, there is no government agency that actually watches the money. That's right. Congress allocates the money, but there's no separate government department to oversee how it's spent. The General Accounting Office is called in only when there's a suspicion of fraud. This means that people who receive federal money do not have to account for it unless asked. You have trillions of federal dollars floating around, basically unsupervised, by anyone other than the Congress people who allotted the money in the first place in order to fund their campaign promises and pet projects. Do you think they want to know that their spending is fraught with waste and fraud? The answer is no. When things get totally out of control, like the Department of Education, the GAO swings into action. But again, that agency does not routinely audit federal expenditures. So by the time the GAO gets on the case, the money is already gone, and the heavy odds are it will not be recovered. So one more time, what we have here in America is trillions of tax dollars being spent every year and no firm system of spending accountability. The next time you hear Hillary Clinton whining about paying down the debt, just know that Mrs. Clinton and most other politicians ran up that debt by failing to establish an efficient system of preventing tax money from being wasted or stolen. They should be ashamed, but they're not. In fact, Al Gore ran on the platform of greatly expanding federal spending and conveniently forgot to address the scourge of government waste. It is your money that is being flushed down the john, and the process is never ending. The withholding in your paycheck is one giant river of currency that flows unimpeded to Washington, with tributary streams to your state capital, mayor's office, and county commission. This mighty Mississippi will never run dry, so let's party hardy and spend that coin. That's what's going on, and no honest person can deny it. Few politicians care about watching your tax dollars. They care about spending them. That's because most federal and state expenditures are designed to get votes. Why do you think the teachers' unions love the Democrats? Why do you think Boeing loves the Republicans? The left diverts tax dollars toward vivid visions of entitlements dancing in voters' heads. The right buys support by advocating increased spending for the military, hello, missile shield, and corporate welfare. But the big dollar promises are paid courtesy of the guy paving over a pothole on your local highway and the lady grinding out memos for a demanding boss. Without access to the weekly paychecks of the vast working class, our public servants might actually have to pick up a shovel or learn some office skills themselves. Shameful and dishonest, tragic and appalling, the waste of our hard-earned tax dollars is the single most scandalous part of American politics. But if we can believe the polls, few Americans care about the tax issue because it is complicated and boring and is spun to death by an avalanche of contradictory or confusing statistics and gross distortions. In other words, this is serious grist for the no-spin zone and its head honcho, me. I am deeply offended by the callous disregard politicians have for our money, so the Zone invited the head of the GAO to entertain the thought of a discussion. David M. Walker is the Comptroller of the United States and a man who I believe is trying his best to supervise a chaotic situation. But as you will see, Mr. Walker's task is just about hopeless. Here's what I said on my television program before introducing Mr. Walker. Who is watching how our tax money is spent? Each government agency or department keeps books, and individual officers of the agencies audit all expenses. Those audits are then sent to the U.S. Treasury and to Congress. The Treasury consolidates the audits into financial statements, stay with me now, and sends those to the GAO. If that sounds confusing, it is, especially when we try to get specific information like, how much did Hillary Clinton's trip to North Africa cost? Where is the $5 billion the Department of Agriculture can't find? And what specifically happened to the $1 billion the Clinton administration sent to Haiti? I then brought out David Walker, and the Zone dance began. I got right to the point. Can you blame me for being confused about the General Accounting Office, Mr. Walker? I can't blame you, Bill, the Comptroller of the United States answered. The fact is that millions of Americans think we keep the books and records and look at every dime the government spends, and that's not true. I told him, we've been trying to find out for more than a year how much money Hillary Clinton, Chelsea, and their entourage spent in their two-week jaunt to North Africa. We can't find out. Can you, Mr. Walker? He said, the entity that's responsible for keeping track of that is the Office of Administration and Management in the White House. All we know is that the lift cost, the expense of flying her around on that trip, was about $2.3 million. But you have no idea about the cost of the entire trip to the taxpayer, I asked? That's correct, because some of the information is not available. What? I exclaimed. What? Wait a minute. What do you mean it's not available? That's my money Hillary was spreading around over there. Well, Walker said, the Secret Service expense is not available for public distribution for security reasons. Besides that, Mr. Walker, can you tell me about the other expenses? I can't tell you. That's not right, Mr. Walker. I'm not criticizing you, but it's not right that Hillary Clinton gets a spring break with Chelsea and her entourage, and we don't know how much it costs 2 years later. I tried another tact. Okay, what about the Department of Education? It doesn't know where $450 million is. The GAO, you guys, pinpointed the missing money. Tell me about it. We know some of the issues, Walker replied. They have fundamental financial management problems. They don't have adequate controls. They don't have adequate accountability. They lost a lot of money. There's no question about it. And you don't know where the money went, do you? I asked. I can't tell you where it is. All right, I said. Let's go to Haiti. $3 billion to Haiti was sent by the Clinton administration. $1 billion of that nobody seems to be able to account for. Do you know where it is? I don't know where it is, said the controller. But let me clarify one thing. Each major department and agency has an inspector general whose job it is to fight waste, fraud, abuse, and mismanagement in their own department. Congress is responsible for doing the oversight. If Congress doesn't call us in, we don't know anything. I understand that, I said, but here's the deal. We have massive taxation in this country. 40 cents out of every dollar a worker earns is taken by the system. I just gave you three examples, and I could give you 30 more, of money that is unaccounted for. Again, I'm not blaming you, Mr. Walker, but don't tell me the American public shouldn't know how much Hillary Clinton is spending, shouldn't know where $1 billion to Haiti went, and shouldn't know about gross waste in various departments, because we should. Bill, I understand your point. One of the things we need, quite frankly, is a modern, integrated financial management system for the entire government. Brazil has one, but we don't have one in the United States. You know, Mr. Walker, I said to him, that is one of the most truthful things any government employee has ever said on this program. We need a central authority that can monitor all taxpayer expenditures, because what we have now is chaotic and the bandits can get away with all kinds of stuff. In my opinion, David Walker is an honest man. And to be fair, the GAO under his guidance did save us taxpayers about $23 billion in the year 2000 by getting refunds for overpayments and similar actions. But that's just a small percentage of the enormous waste that's built into all levels of government. Of course, the politicians know the system is corrupt and chaotic, but to them, that's a good thing. It is far easier to reward supporters with spending projects that are basically unsupervised. Campaigning for office is really about promising things. The more unsupervised money there is, the more promises that can be fulfilled, the more fun that can be had by the lucky in-crowd. The Clintons, all-time champions of making promises, took advantage of the tax money situation to an extent never before seen in America. Pursuing Hillary Clinton's 1998 junket to North Africa, my staff and I followed a spending trail right to Hillary's doorstep. But then we were stopped cold. You see, according to a federal law called the Presidential Records Act, occupants of the White House do not have to turn over any documents, including expenses, for 5 years after they leave Pennsylvania Avenue. What a scam! Hillary Clinton's office told my investigators to fly off. They laughed in our faces as they quoted the Records Act. But here's what I was able to ascertain with the help of GAO reports and analysis by the National Taxpayers Union. In the 8 years they spent in the White House, Mr. and Mrs. Clinton spent close to, take a breath, $525 million of taxpayer money for their travels. This is by far the most money ever spent by a president and first lady in that area. And what do we, the people, get for all that travel? Well, you can make that call. And what did Bill Clinton get? In his first 5 months out of office, he visited nearly 24 countries and picked up approximately $5 million in speaking fees. The relationships he made abroad while president have certainly paid off. Unfortunately, the Clintons are far from being the only ones who've made careers and names for themselves by trumpeting their noble intentions, while at the same time carefully skirting the issue of accountability. The soaring rhetoric of people like Ronald Reagan and Mario Cuomo often emphasized their great vision for the USA and their sympathetic understanding of the downtrodden. But much of the talk turned out to be very, very expensive for you and me. Once again, this is not about compassion or helping Americans who need help. Most of us support that noble goal. But without financial accountability and rigid supervision, compassionate programs hurt more Americans, working-class taxpayers, than they help financially strapped citizens. Talk is cheap. Giant entitlement programs like free health insurance and prescription drugs are incredibly expensive. But those who champion massive entitlements feel very comfortable on the high moral ground. Take, for example, former New York Governor Mario Cuomo's keynote address to the 1984 Democratic Convention. Fine writing delivered well by one of the most effective orators of our time, Cuomo's speech detailing his view of America's responsibility to our poorest citizens was a smash hit and put him into presidential contention. The speech not only affected the national debate on domestic policy, it also led to millions of dollars of speaking fees for Mario Cuomo. In 1992, in order to calm left-leaning Democrats who thought nominee Bill Clinton might be too much of a centrist, Governor Cuomo was asked to deliver Clinton's nominating speech at the party convention in New York City. Mario Cuomo served as New York governor from 1983 to 1994. During the Reagan boom years, he was one of the biggest spenders in state history, increasing New York's expenditures by a whopping 10% a year. In order to fund his programs, Cuomo had to raise taxes and did so with a vengeance. By the early 90s, the governor was hiking up taxes by $1 billion or more each year. One disastrous result was a business exodus from New York State that cost the region more than 500,000 jobs. And on his watch, despite the flood of new programs and agencies, rates of welfare dependence, crime, and drug addiction soared. Cuomo's approval rating plummeted, and in 1994 he was defeated by little-known state legislator George Pataki. Even in New York, one of the most liberal places in the country, voters wanted tax relief. Still, Mario Cuomo remains unrepentant about his tax and spend philosophy. Since he continues to be a Democratic icon and a smart guy, I very much wanted to get him into the zone. But the former governor resisted, even though his son Chris was a correspondent for the Fox News Channel that carries the O'Reilly Factor. Finally, when I happened to see the elder Cuomo in Rockefeller Center one day, I approached him and blurted out, "Hey, Governor, are you avoiding me? My mother says you are." Mario Cuomo laughed and shook his head. We talked a bit, and he agreed to come on my program. A few weeks later, he kept his word, even though he knew the conversation would be tough because I believe taxes are out of control. "I want a tax cut," I said straight out. "I'm sure you want it," Cuomo conceded. "Let's help the working guy," I said. "Let's do away with the payroll tax for Social Security and give everybody who works an immediate 12% raise." "I have a deal for you," Cuomo said. "We should say to President Bush, we saw you with your pictures of middle-class workers and poor workers, saying these people would get tax cuts. We love the pictures. We notice you didn't take any pictures with millionaires. We'll give you the tax cuts right now for the poor and middle class and argue about the rest later. What would you say to that, Bill?" "I would say," I answered, "that Mr. Bush doesn't believe, as you do, in income redistribution. He wants an across-the-board tax cut." "No, no, you're wrong. But, Bill, I know your opinion of taxes is good for your popularity ratings. What is the space program? What is the defense budget? These are redistributions of wealth." "Wait a minute," I said. "That's not redistribution." "Of course it is. You took my wealth and redistributed it to purposes I didn't want." "You don't want a defense budget?" I asked. "Not the size of it," the governor said. "Not the waste that it is. Not this missile defense shield." "Well, I agree with you on the waste," I said, "but not on the redistribution." "No, it is redistribution when I take money from you and spend it on something else," Cuomo insisted. "No, give it to somebody else, not spend it on something," I insisted. "For 30 years, you guys in the Democratic Party have been driving entitlements for the poor, and the poverty rate has not changed. One more question. I'm for a national sales tax in place of the payroll tax. Would you favor that?" "Not instead of a progressive tax, which would take you, who makes millions of dollars, you deserve it, and say, now you only have to pay the same tax as me, and I'm homeless. Come on, Governor. I will buy far more and pay far more in taxes for doing so." "That's nice if you're rich," Cuomo said. "It's not nice if you are middle class or poor. And that's why we don't have it, because there are more working class people than O'Reilly's. Governor, I'm still carrying the load by buying an expensive car and home. I'm paying far more in tax than someone who's living modestly," I said. "Of course," said Cuomo. "If you can afford the big car, you don't care. But what about people who can't afford things?" I answered, "Going to a national sales tax just gave them a 12% raise as the payroll tax is abolished." I'll give you the last word. The truth is that you can make the weaker part of this country much stronger without making the stronger part weaker by giving people better education, better health care, better protection at the work site, and paying more attention to the middle class and poor. People see that, Governor Cuomo said. What a wrap-up. Concise, effective, right on the dot for people who support his point of view. The governor is still a master of rhetoric, but I firmly believe that he is wrong. He and many other liberal Americans love so-called progressive taxation. In other words, they want to take money from the wealthy and give it to Americans who need it more. As I stated, my national sales tax plan would pay for sharply focused entitlements to the less fortunate by taxing people on what they spend rather than on what they earn. If you work hard, then you'd have far more control over your take-home pay. And poor Americans would keep every dime they make because the earned income tax credit means they already pay no federal income tax. In addition, my plan would eliminate the payroll tax everybody is paying now. But that's not enough for Governor Cuomo and many others. They want the power to take money from the wealthy. The rich already pay the vast majority of federal income tax as President Clinton raised the top tax bracket to 39.9%. President Bush has scaled it back to 36%. But in big tax states like New York, a top wage earner brushes up against a 50% levy, and that's not counting all the add-ons such as sales tax, property tax, etc. I don't weep for the Donald Trumps of the world, but I do ask this fundamental question. Was America set up to take money from one citizen and give it to another? During the Depression of the 1930s, this philosophy was embraced by President Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who said, "Our revenue laws have operated in many ways to the unfair advantage of the few, and they have done little to prevent an unjust concentration of wealth and economic power." Roosevelt was right and wrong. All Americans should pay their fair share, and some fat cats were avoiding taxes in the roaring 20s. The need for financial supervision at the federal level was obvious, and Roosevelt kicked it in, becoming a champion of the working class in the process. And even today, some wealthy Americans continue to exploit our capitalistic system. Hello to the Clinton-pardoned Mark Rich. But no system is perfect, and the United States is not Sweden. America was set up so that individuals could prosper and take it to the capitalistic limit. If that system is no longer valid, we should hold a national debate and vote on it. But to federally impose quasi-socialism goes against our heritage and has been proved to be a failure. Time and time again, the entitlement culture championed by people like Mario Cuomo has failed, and trillions of tax dollars have been wasted on programs that sounded good. If I believed progressive taxation led to the lessening of social problems, I would be Governor Cuomo's best ideological pal. But I deal in facts, not Land of Oz fantasies. Hard work and discipline lead to economic success. Government handouts and unsupervised policies of pity only rob people of incentive. If tax money continues to be wasted, it becomes morally wrong for our government to confiscate huge percentages of income and property from Americans, even if they are wealthy. Right now, our national slogan is, "The more you make, the more we take," and we're not even going to watch how we spend it. Welfare has failed. Public housing is a shambles. Public education is a mess. The poverty rate remains unchanged, and yet the big government beat goes on. In 1766, Benjamin Franklin warned the British Parliament that if the stamp tax wasn't repealed, the colonies might well revolt. Today our tax situation is revolting, sorry, but too many of us remain passive in the face of it. The road to hell is paved with good intentions, and you know what? Those intentions are being paid for big time by all working Americans. It is enough to test even the strongest person's sobriety. Which brings us to another vexing problem, drugs. Chapter 12, Issue 12, America's Drug Culture. The opponents, John McCain, Senator from Arizona, former drug czar, General Barry McCaffrey, and Ted Demme, Hollywood director. The United States government does not want to win the war on drugs. I firmly believe that, based upon my years of reporting and interviewing those involved. Despite expenditures north of $30 billion a year fighting illegal narcotics, there is more dope on the streets of America than ever before, and according to the Drug Enforcement Agency, the drugs get purer and more addictive every year. So what's the deal? Well, the truth is that the powers that be simply do not have the courage to take the difficult and controversial steps necessary to control the lucrative narcotics business. Big business always frightens politicians, and this is very big business. Here's a glimpse of how big. There are in excess of 10 million heavy drug users in the USA. Approximately 70% of street crime is drug-related. Approximately 70% of all child abuse is committed by substance abusers. That includes people who abuse alcohol. There are more than 1 million DUI arrests annually in the United States. With statistics like that, even someone high on ecstasy or crank could figure it out. Intoxication is a horrendous problem in America. Now for a dose of reality. No government is ever going to stop all its citizens from intoxicating themselves, ever. There have always been and will always be substance abusers. We must start there. As far as I'm concerned, if the abuser keeps it inside, I don't care. You want to stay stoned all day long? Fine, as long as you don't hurt your children, although just that scenario hurts them. Or ask me to chip in for your welfare check. Get stoned, but stay off the streets. But if you intrude on my freedom while intoxicated, then I have a big problem with you, and the government has a responsibility to side with me. I want to be protected from you. I don't want you in my face or around my family, and I have a right under equal protection of the law to demand that. I don't want you providing a terrible example for my children. I don't want you using my tax money to get high, and I don't want you behind the wheel of any vehicle. Unfortunately, the government at this point is not taking my rights seriously. The authorities are allowing drug markets to exist, and some of them are right out in the open. Those are usually in the poor neighborhoods, and that is a subtle form of racism if there ever was one. And rather than treat the minority of dopeheads who actually want to quit the habit, law enforcement often allows drug offenders to leave custody without any requirement for follow-up drug testing. And that's just the beginning of our government's irresponsible and socially dangerous behavior. The feds simply will not properly patrol the border with Mexico for fear of offending that country. And severe penalties are often not imposed on street dope pushers. These life-destroying criminals, considered pariahs in a saner era, are now even lionized in some movies, recordings, and TV shows. There are three basic strategies needed to control America's drug problem. First, impose coerced drug rehab on all criminals who are arrested and test positive for narcotics. Second, use the U.S. military to assist the Border Patrol from Brownsville, Texas to Imperial Beach, California, and use the Navy to assist the Coast Guard. And third, sentence major and persistent drug sellers to banishment in faraway federal penitentiaries. I've discussed the coerced drug rehab strategy in detail in my book, The O'Reilly Factor. Rather than repeat myself, I'll just explain that the basic idea is to empower authorities to keep drug-involved criminals off the streets for months and sometimes years in therapeutic drug prisons. The aim is to change their behavior drastically. They would be provided with psychological help as well as life skill training. Upon release from the facility, the person would be drug tested every few days. Anyone who tests dirty goes back inside. This program has impressively reduced recidivism in Alabama. It works. My second strategy would cut the drug flow across the southern border in half within months. Using high-tech surveillance gear, our military could interdict not only drugs but also other types of contraband and stem the flow of illegal immigrants at the same time. Remember, the military's mandate is to protect the borders of our country. President Bush the Elder declared drug importation a national security problem, and he was right. There is no reason on this earth why the highly trained and effective U.S. military is not being used to prevent the flow of drugs into this country. When you have a national security problem, and the drug problem is certainly that, deal with it. My third strategy is based upon one simple fact. Drug dealers are scum. So far as they're concerned, I've got the same question I asked earlier about the NAMBLA degenerates. Where's the outrage? Where is public opinion? Why are these people not shunned for being the corruptors they are? Like the ACLU on NAMBLA, we are accepting the unacceptable if a person selling narcotics does not anger us. Back in the 1960s, my father told me that anyone who dealt dope was a parasite, a person beneath contempt. I always remembered that. How many children are being told that today, especially in the ghetto neighborhoods? What do kids think when they encounter the sleazy dealer? The following story may provide a sad clue. As a correspondent for ABC News in 1988, I did a story about drug trafficking in South Central Los Angeles. I went into a housing project and began interviewing people. A large crowd gathered, and I asked, "Is there anyone here who is morally opposed to drug dealing?" No one raised his or her hand. They might have been frightened, but after an initial short silence, I heard all kinds of excuses. "The dealers give us money. The white man controls the drug trade. There's nothing wrong with getting high." No one stepped forward and said, "Man, these pushers are ruining the weakest among us, including children. They sell poison. They are parasites." Until Americans of every stripe step up and say that and demand that the police sweep dealers off the streets, the dope war will not be won. Until public pressure forces our apathetic and frightened politicians to get really tough on those who sell narcotics, Americans will continue to die with needles in their arms, prostitute themselves, infect each other with the AIDS virus, and steal anything they can. How much heartache has to pass through the nation before society reacts? Are you going to wait until it's your kid with the drug problem? As for the media, their delayed reaction and their lack of responsibility have been, generally speaking, disgraceful. If the stars aren't flaunting their own personal drug use, Eminem, Cheech and Chong, they are participating in projects that glorify drugs and alcohol, and cigarettes for that matter. Movies have made brilliant use of charismatic stars and flashy cinematography to make the drug world look lucrative and normal. Business as usual, babes ahoy. One such project is the movie Blows, starring Johnny Depp and Penelope Cruz, two attractive actors who directly appeal to young people. The film is based on the life of convicted cocaine dealer George Young, who is currently serving 20 years in prison. Before the system finally caught up with Young, he smuggled drugs for more than 20 years, supplying thousands of tons of cocaine to millions of Americans. He accumulated millions of dollars that he spent on himself. Women threw themselves at him. The Young party was constant and unrelenting, and the movie documents all of it. What the film does not address is that many people became hooked from using Young's stuff. How many people died or became crack whores or gave birth to addicted children because George Young was in business? Hollywood was not interested in that story. The director of Blow, Ted Demme, is an accomplished professional, but he does not see George Young the same way I see him. So the stage was set as Demme blew into the no-spin zone. I think dealing hard drugs like cocaine is a crime against humanity, I told Demme, and I would give guys like George Young more than 20 years in prison. Demme tried to defend his movie. I mean, look, George Young is 58 years old, and this guy is an ex-drug addict, and I think these guys need rehab more than hard time. He's selling drugs for what, 25 years, I asked? Since 1968, probably, Demme said. He makes millions, right? He gets to hang around with ladies who look like Penelope Cruz. He lives a life that hardworking Americans could never live. Luxury. Then he gets caught. And you're telling me, Mr. Demme, that he shouldn't be doing 20 years? I think the crime he was busted for didn't merit 20 years, Demme said. He's not a murderer. George had come from a family where he had seen his father work his entire life harder than he should have, with nothing to show for it. And he didn't have any good role models around to show him what a good day's pay would earn and how to earn a proper living. You have to understand these guys. I retorted, my father worked hard his whole life, and he didn't have a hell of a lot to show for it. Well, mine did too, the director admitted. And we don't sell drugs, do we? He wasn't selling it, Demme said. He was bringing it into this country. That's selling it, Mr. Demme. So he should equal a murderer, Demme asked. He's worse than a murderer, I said. This guy deals for 25 years in weight cocaine. Untold thousands of people use this drug, and some of them destroy their lives. Demme gave an old argument, or what passes for an argument. No one forced them to use it. That's their own fault. The person who snorts it is responsible. If nobody sold drugs, Mr. Demme, there wouldn't be any drug addicts. And I have a problem with you, too. You put together a movie that a lot of people are going to see. You've got Johnny Depp playing this young guy. And you yourself don't believe Young should pay society for what he did for 25 years, and I'm appalled by that. I don't believe in capital punishment, but if I did, this guy should be dead. I've got a problem with the message you're sending. Bill, you're naive, Demme told me. Putting people in jail for life is not going to stop drug dealing. It won't stop the problem. You're in denial, as much of the rest of the country is, about our drug problem. The problem isn't with the people who are selling it. It's that there's no rehab, man. Ted Demme is a powerful filmmaker, but his permissive attitude on drug dealers hurts this country. There are plenty of poor kids who would trade 20 years of living large for 20 years in prison, especially if the Ted Demmes of the world will pity them. Many critics said the message of Blow was ambiguous. Let me tell you, it wasn't. Johnny Depp had a great time dealing drugs. Too bad he got caught. Short of mass murder, the American media almost never condemn any antisocial activity because there's always an excuse for the behavior. George Young didn't have any positive role models. Come on. This is garbage. Disgraceful people like Young should be banished for decades, if not for life. They should be forced to endure hard labor in prison. In short, they should be harshly punished for inflicting so much damage upon this country. Anything short of that is irresponsible and terribly misguided. But the powers that be, the people who are supposed to counter the Ted Demmes of the world, are often woefully lacking in the kind of analytical and tough-minded thinking that would make an impression on the future George Youngs of the world. One of those persons is General Barry McCaffrey, who served for 5 years as President Clinton's drug czar. General McCaffrey is a West Point graduate who served America honorably in Vietnam. He was a controversial commander in the Gulf War, as a few of his men accused him of ordering the destruction of defenseless, fleeing Iraqis. Be that as it may, the general's most important job was to direct the USA's attack on the drug trade. But in my opinion, he had no effective strategy and no will to win. My interview with him came shortly after he became the director of White House drug policy in 1996. At the time, the no-spin zone was not widely known, and the general was not pleased he had walked into an ambush. I started out by asking General McCaffrey, do you have any plan at all to turn this drug thing around? We have a national strategy in front of the American people, the general responded. It's systemic. It says, let's stay engaged for 10 years. Let's work drug prevention and drug treatment. Well, I said, that strategy hasn't worked in the past. I mean, we had Just Say No with Nancy Reagan, but we still have plenty of drug addicts. The real problem is that American youngsters are doing drugs again, the general said. Since 1990, we've seen a steady erosion in their commitment to disapprove drug use. I interrupted. Let me stop you there. I disagree with you. 70% of all street crime is caused by drug-involved people. 70% of all child abuse is caused by substance abusers. Most of the AIDS cases right now are being spread by intravenous drug users. These are grim stats. It is clear that drug use is a grim specter, General McCaffrey agreed. It costs America $67 billion a year in various costs. But if we get serious about the issue, we can make a difference. But you can't stop drugs from coming into the United States, I pointed out. I agree. So what are you going to do? You have to treat the root cause. At the end of the day, you understand that a holistic approach is likely to be helpful. With all due respect to the general, he was clueless. And 5 years later, I think that is fully apparent. The Clinton administration did absolutely nothing to improve the drug problem in this country, despite a massive amount of anti-drug spending. Will President Bush's policies be any more effective? Not likely, unless he diverts federal drug funding into state-coerced rehab programs and orders the military to police the porous southern border. Realistically, I don't believe he'll do it. The strategy is too controversial, as many viewers remind me every time I bring the subject up on The Factor. Also, there's not enough voter support, as many people simply don't understand the seriousness of the border situation. Finally, the action could tee off some Mexican Americans, as well as the Mexican government, causing all kinds of panicked headlines for Mr. Bush. Papers like the New York Times would go wild, conjuring up editorial images of a police state. The president's enemies in Congress would yell long and loud about misuse of power and the poor aliens and on and on. So don't look for any bold solutions in the drug fight anytime soon. Only a leader fully committed to taking risks could dent the drug traffic, and we don't have that kind of leader in this country right now. Tomorrow, Mr. Bush could order an aggressive anti-drug campaign, damning the torpedoes and going full speed ahead. It would be a gutsy but potentially damaging move politically, and political expediency usually rules. Not too many Americans remember, but 2 years ago, the House of Representatives did pass a resolution that would have put the military on the border, only to see the bill die in the Senate. And one of the senators who remains opposed to the military strategy is John McCain of Arizona. This is somewhat puzzling to me. Arizona has 300 miles of border with Mexico, and close to 1 million people are arrested in the border area each year. That's the number caught. No one knows how many illegal immigrants and drug-carrying thugs are sneaking through undetected. You'd think a senator from a state plagued with these severe problems would be pleading for federal help. And Arizona is not a wealthy state. In fact, the border problems are crippling it financially at an estimated $150 million a year, or almost 10% of the state's budget. That's spent trying to control the border. That money, of course, could be used to combat other social problems. For example, Arizona has the highest high school dropout rate in the country, and its educational system is in disarray. I can't agree with Senator McCain's position, but I like him. I'm not exactly sure why, since he and his campaign people were tough to deal with during the presidential primaries, but I admire his passion and his anti-establishment edge. Besides, after entering the zone a number of times in recent years, he provided me with a slyly funny blurb from my previous book. He said, I just returned from a trip to Vietnam, and one of the reasons I went was to prepare myself for being back on the O'Reilly Factor because Bill O'Reilly uses some of their old interrogation techniques. I love that blurb. But when I faced Senator McCain on the border issue, I brought every technique I knew to bear in order to stimulate the debate. I began, do you favor, Senator, putting troops on the U.S. border? I do not favor using troops because they're not trained for it, McCain replied. They don't have the qualifications necessary. I strongly favor us using all the technical equipment our military has, including satellites and aircraft. But our military is not trained to do the groundwork. Wait a minute, Senator, I said. Our military is guarding the border of Korea and Bosnia right now. Surely we can train them to back up the border patrol and discourage illegal crossings. McCain said, our military is guarding against invasion. Our border patrol is the agency that can deal with this. We also have to do a lot more drug enforcement. But that hasn't worked, I pointed out. For 20 years, it hasn't worked. The long-term answer is a healthy Mexican economy, argued McCain. Many of us are very encouraged by the election of Vicente Fox. We have great confidence in him. I'm not going to let you off the hook, Senator. You say that the armed forces are not trained to patrol the border, and my contention is that the men and women in the armed forces are intelligent enough to take on this assignment. It's you guys in Washington that don't have the will, and I don't know why, to solve this problem. McCain insisted, we are a multicultural state, and we're very proud of our heritage. We want to do everything possible to enforce our borders. That's our obligation to do that. Senator, Arizona's jails are overflowing, I said. You have 1 million arrests on the border. Don't you have to put the American people ahead of the Mexican people? Well, Bill, Senator McCain said, there are many Hispanic citizens of the state of Arizona who are proud of their culture, and I'm not sure they would agree with you. So what are you going to do then? I demanded. Do you have anything new on the table to stop drugs and the aliens? Yes, we have, the senator replied. We have dramatically increased funding for the border. We'll continue to use military hardware, but again, the real solution to the problem is a healthy Mexican economy. We're the only nation in the world with an advanced economy that has a nation on its border that has the economy the Mexicans do. And all of this is complicated by the flow of drugs as well. Finally, I believe President Bush is well-equipped and knowledgeable about this issue and has it as one of his highest priorities. Senator, I said, always a pleasure to debate with you. Do you agree with Senator McCain? I mean, do you really believe more spending is going to solve the border problem? Does anyone believe that? And as for making drug smuggling and border jumping less attractive by strengthening the huge, chaotic Mexican economy, that's a great idea. But do you see that happening any time this century? So once again, we have the customary Washington answer, even from the so-called maverick senator. Pour even more money into a complicated situation and hope for an economic miracle south of the border. That's the Beltway mentality in spades. When will they ever learn? Never. That's when. What explains this nonsense? The clue comes in Senator McCain's comments about ethnic sensitivities. The conventional wisdom in Washington runs something like this. Hispanic Americans would be insulted by the installation of troops on the border, and the Mexican politicos would go loco en la cabeza. Possibly, but I wonder if anyone has taken the time to ask Hispanic parents how they feel about drugs streaming across the border towards the playgrounds of their children. I bet they don't believe that multiculturalism is a reason to ignore the 22 pounds of heroin, 4,780 pounds of cocaine, and 175,000 pounds of marijuana seized at the Arizona border in the year 2000. I don't believe anyone thinks that ethnic pride has anything to do with the fact that Arizona has to spend more money each year on substance abuse than on Medicaid. So what about that, Washington? This particular interview with Senator John McCain took place in May 2001. A day later, 14 Mexican men and teenage boys were found dead from exposure and thirst in the brutal Devil's Path, a searing, desolate stretch of land east of Yuma in the Arizona desert. Their bodies were so dehydrated that one official described them as mummified. They succumbed in 115-degree heat, some 50 miles from the nearest road. This horror was not unprecedented. From September 30, 1999, through September 30, 2000, the bodies of 106 illegals were found near the Arizona border. I don't believe such catastrophes would occur if the U.S. military had been patrolling there with state-of-the-art surveillance equipment. In fact, hundreds, perhaps thousands of Mexican lives would be saved each year. In addition, the USA would be far more protected from the accelerating invasion, and that's what it is, of undocumented aliens and lethal drugs. Someone needs to remind our leaders that we have a constitution and that it requires, among other things, that the federal government protect the states from invasion. You might tell your representatives to look it up, Article 4, Section 4. I read those words to refute Senator McCain, who has said publicly that putting the military on the border would be a slippery slope of dubious constitutionality. I stand with Dave Stoddard, the former Border Patrol supervisor in Arizona and a 27-year veteran of the agency. Mr. Stoddard entered the zone and made the following points. 1. The United States military is the best equipped, best trained, and most technologically advanced such force in the world. 2. It was Mr. Stoddard's experience that the mere presence of the U.S. military on the border deters illegal aliens as well as narcotics trafficking. 3. He would put the military on the border, regain control, and deploy their numbers and strength from Brownsville, Texas, to San Diego. Sometimes it makes sense to listen to the experts. But I don't hear many other media voices demanding action on this problem or many of the other complicated situations we as Americans are facing. During 8 years of Clintonism, the elite media, most notably the network TV news divisions, have been very wary of making any waves. They very rarely investigated governmental wrongdoing until a scandal got so big they were forced to pay attention, and Bill Clinton himself was given almost a complete pass. But why? I won't try to tell you. I'll leave that to CBS anchorman Dan Rather, who is next up in the no-spin zone. It was an experience we'll both remember. Chapter 13, Issue 13, The Failure of Network TV News to Investigate the Powerful. Opponent Dan Rather, CBS News anchorman. We go back, Dan Rather and I, way back. In 1981, I was promoted from reporter for WCBS-TV, the CBS network's flagship station in New York City, to CBS News correspondent. That leap into the national news scene is the dream of many local reporters. Dan Rather had just recently replaced Walter Cronkite, the nation's most trusted man, according to the polls, as anchor for the CBS Evening News. Rather was already famous in his own right for taking on Richard Nixon and for his aggressive, authoritative reporting all over the world. He was making it clear that he wanted to mold his news team in his relatively youthful, fearless image. That sounded like the right fit to me. I was already known in the TV industry as a take-no-prisoners reporter. I had recently won an Emmy for investigating corruption in the New York City Marshal's office, and my no-spin approach was rapidly developing. I thought my future with the new-look CBS News operation was going to be bright. Saner people who knew my brash personality suspected otherwise. Some veteran news people warned me not to take the CBS job because, as they politely expressed it, I was not a team player. And that was true. I was and still am a journalistic gunslinger. I look the story in the eye and shoot it down. I don't need four other people telling me what I'm looking at. Although I was too simple to realize it at the time, that kind of attitude would make many CBS News veterans dislike me right off the bat. More than a few would take absolute delight in seeing me fail. Some older people who liked me knew this, but I shrugged off their advice, only seeing the glamour of reporting for the nation's premier television news operation. I should have heeded the warnings, but as usual, I swaggered in there thinking I was going to conquer the situation. Let me elaborate a bit further on this team player business, since it is currently in vogue, especially in the corporate world of TV news. Good journalism is best done by a person who is honest, accurate, and observant. From the beginning of my career in Scranton, Pennsylvania, I've always written my own scripts, asked my own questions, and evaluated the validity of the answers. I find it unnecessary to have somebody else back in the broadcast center, a person who was not present at the scene of the story, rewrite my report or give me a point of view. Perhaps I'm conceited, I know you're shocked, but that's the way I feel about it. Why hire me to report unless you trust my reporting? I proved myself early on by rising quickly through the ranks and winning a bunch of reporting awards. In my 27 years as a journalist, I have never had to retract a story and I have never lost a lawsuit. I simply don't believe in reporting by committee. But CBS News did. The culture there dictated that new young correspondents were to do what they were told to do, say what they were told to say. And that was that. Just shut up and do it. Do you sense a collision coming between the corporation and your humble correspondent? It didn't take long. A few weeks after taking the CBS job, I was flown to El Salvador to report on the war going on down there at the time. I drew an assignment that sent me to the Morazan province in the mountainous northeastern region of that beautiful country. This was Indian country, a place where the communist guerrillas, Los Muchachos, operated with impunity. It was a dangerous place, and my crew, a driver, producer, and cameraman, were not thrilled to be going there. It took us a full day to drive to Morazan from San Salvador, the capital city, because all the bridges had been blown up and we had to ford rivers in our van. This was slow going, making us easy targets. Our only protection was a message painted in black letters over and over again on the sides of the van. Periodistas, no dispare. Journalists, don't shoot. None of us had much confidence that message would be heeded. After about 8 hours on the road, we rolled into the small town of San Francisco Gotera, the last village in the province held by the U.S.-backed government troops. The soldiers were housed in an old-style fort, complete with wooden walls. As we drove through the gates, we saw three men hanging from hooks by their tied wrists. They were being whipped. We thought they were captured guerrillas. We were wrong. It turned out that they were Salvadoran soldiers who had fallen asleep on guard duty the night before. The captain in charge of the garrison cheerfully told me that he would have shot the men, except they were all under the age of 16. But the next time they did not fulfill the assignment, he would shoot them pronto. Nobody doubted his word. El Capitan also gave us the local war news. The muchachos had wiped out a small village called Mienguera, a few miles to the south, because its mayor was deemed friendly to the government. The atrocity had not been confirmed, though, because nobody in his right mind would go into the guerrilla-controlled area. When I told the captain that my assignment was to check the story out, he rolled his eyes, smiled, and said, "Vaya con Dios, go with God." God was good. And after traversing the worst road I've ever seen, we arrived in Mienguera without incident a few hours later. The place was leveled to the ground and fires were still smoldering, but even though the carnage was obviously recent, we saw no one live or dead. There was absolutely nobody around who could tell us what happened. I quickly did a stand-up amid the rubble, and we got the hell out of there. As we were making our way back to the safety of the fort, a group of heavily armed men suddenly appeared in the road ahead of us and waved for us to stop. This is one of the worst things that can happen in any out-of-control war zone. Slowly, and I mean slowly, we got out of the van with our hands up. The leader of the group, a teenager, had a bullet bill crisscrossing his chest. All the teens were wearing bandanas. Who the hell were these guys? After eyeing us for about 2 minutes, the leader stepped forward and identified himself as a sergeant in the Salvadoran army. Turned out that he and his boys were government soldiers on a reconnaissance patrol. I quickly mentioned the captain's name and that we had been up to Mienguera. They all had a big laugh over that, saying we had cojones. Within a few minutes, we were back on the wretched but welcomed road to San Salvador. The next day, I filed my report. I explained that while a scorched earth policy was clearly in effect in remote villages, the evidence was right there on tape. It was impossible to say just who was doing the scorching. Could be the muchachos, could be the government. The 90-second package contained great video and a fairly impressive on-the-scene-in-a-very-bad-place stand-up by yours truly. I was looking forward to seeing Dan Rather introduce your humble but now macho correspondent on the CBS Evening News. It never happened. When I called New York to find out the status of the story, the foreign editor said he never received it and had no idea where it was. But he promised he would look for it. A few days later, the guy called me and said he hadn't really found the El Salvador report yet, but, by the way, we are sending you to Argentina. In 1982, the Falkland Islands War between Great Britain and Argentina was making worldwide headlines, and CBS had a huge presence in Buenos Aires, the Argentine capital. I arrived in that vast city early in the morning after an overnight flight from Miami, as per company instructions. I was told there would be a CBS driver to meet me and guide me quickly through customs. Guess what? Nobody showed up. I was beginning to see a pattern. More than a little teed off, I made my way finally to the Buenos Aires Sheraton Hotel, where CBS News had set up offices. I got straight to the point with the bureau chief. Why had I been stranded at the airport? He crisply replied that he had more important things to worry about, and one more thing. He had no idea I was even coming. He also had no idea who I was, me being new and all. Things continued downhill. What happened to me in Argentina is told in meticulous detail in my novel, Those Who Trespass. The short version is this. All hell broke loose in Buenos Aires when the Argentines surrendered to the British. Thousands of Argentines took to the streets screaming for the head of President General Leopoldo Galtieri. Said mob stormed the presidential palace, the Casa Rosada, and were met by the army, which quickly opened fire. A major riot ensued, and many were killed. I was right in the middle of the riot and nearly died of a heart attack when a soldier, standing about 10 feet away, pointed his automatic weapon directly at my head. But again, God